Why are we the first front in this battle? We all have our own dying family members to worry about. Where's your family? And it turns out that his wife was on some extended European vacation, and he did not want to bother her, and he didn't want to make his kids sad. So what are we going to tell them? Just us. We get to carry the weight of this thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Soup Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I am Jessica Henkin.
And today we have another episode in the series we're calling Return to the Soup, in which we feature a memorable soup story and explore various questions with the storyteller.
Before we get started, though, we want to thank our sponsor, Park School, which is a pre-K through grade 12 school located just outside of Baltimore. And today on Return to the Stoop, we have Kevin Hoffman, who is, currently you are the chief financial officer of Conscious Corner. In addition, you are a friend of mine from childhood and an ex-boyfriend and a friend. So went from friend to boyfriend to ex-boyfriend to friend.
That is true.
And that's all very relevant to the story.
Has nothing to do with the story.
Not at all.
I just want everyone to know that. And then, but we're going to hear your story that you told on the Stoop stage when we were at Center Stage in Baltimore in 2009. Holy cow.
That's going way back. So let's listen to Kevin Hoffman's story. The show was called You Want Fries With That? And it was all stories about jobs and work. And this one was a doozy.
Back in the mid-90s, I worked for a small biotechnology company. We manufactured diagnostic test kits to test people for infectious disease. And You're gonna make me fuck up. Yeah. We had recently been purchased by another company out of the northeastern United States, and we had about 15 employees, one of which was Mark, the previous owner who had stayed on, and the person that the new company had installed as our leader, George. George was 65 years old. He lived up in Massachusetts with his wife, and he had some grown kids throughout the country. He would fly down on Monday and fly back up on Thursday or Friday to be with her. He was a smart man. He had two PhDs. He had a long and successful career in the industry. He was about 6'4", 300 pounds, big guy. He was boisterous, jovial, arrogant man. Everything was always about George, and loudly. And one time he flew down here and arrived at the office drenched from head to toe in sweat and in a lot of pain. It started in his knee and moved its way up to his neck. Something was wrong, but why did he fly here? Why didn't he stay home and go to the doctor? But here he was, and he just deteriorated. He was just not getting any better. It just quickly became the focus of our jobs to take care of George, to make sure that he got to and from work and that he had food and drink and was comfortable. We did get him to see one doctor for one opinion, and we had this big company meeting one day. We're all in there. George and Mark are up there, and George says this doctor has taken some scans of his spinal column. And spinal column. And he thinks he has spinal cancer, and he's not going to live very long. It's horrible. George is crying, and we're all upset. But wait a second. Why are we the first front in this battle? We all have our own dying family members to worry about. Where's your family? And it turns out that his wife was on some extended European vacation, and he did not want to bother her, and he didn't want to make his kids sad. So what are we going to tell them? Just us. We get to carry the weight of this thing. And so soon after that meeting, next to his desk appears this big reclining lazy boy chair that he had delivered from his apartment, because now, very rationally, George has decided he's going to move into the office. This is a business park in Columbia. There's nobody there at night except for George in his chair moaning. And at that point, the spectrum of things that we had to do for George had started to widen a little bit. I am washing his testicles in the office shower. And we're having to empty his bedpan. It's crazy, and this is, goes on for week after week, and no one believes that it is happening to us. We would call the parent company and say, George has moved into the office, and he's dying, and he won't go. Help! And they would say, can't be that bad. Get back to work. And one time it was my turn to put the salve on George's now, for some reason, very swollen foot. Normally George's foot was pretty big, but now it's fucking huge and bright red, and all the skin is peeling off the top. It looks like it's on fire, and I don't know what to do with a foot like that. Do you poke a little hole and let it dribble out slowly, or I'll cut the whole thing open and let it pour into a bowl? I don't know. And so I look up at him and I say, George, that's gonna fall off. I don't know what to do here. I've not been trained to deal with this. Look, here's my training file. Nothing about a swollen foot. But I do know of a place where there are a lot of people that have the knowledge and the expertise to help you with your problems. Why don't you go to a hospital? I'll never forget. He says, Kevin, come closer, because I'm down by his foot. He can't speak loudly anymore, because every minor vibration from his vocal cord is sending waves of pain through his body. And I get up there and he says, Kevin, I will not go to a hospital because people get sick in hospitals. And it kind of threw me off a little. I wanted to state the obvious. George, you get any sicker, you are going to be dead. But I didn't say that because you want to be comforting to someone in that position. I just said something like, no, that sounds reasonable. You're the boss, keep paying me. And went back to putting the ointment on his foot. But it's at that point, though, we just realized there was nothing we could do except wait for something terrible to happen. And lucky for us, about a week later, I come into work and I'm walking down this one hallway that leads directly to George's office. And as I'm getting closer, he's sprawled out on his chair, and he looks worse than I'd ever seen him. Looks to me like he's no longer amongst the living. But I hear voices down the hall, so I go there, and I find Pam, the head of research and development, and the ex-wife of Mark, previous owner, which is a different story. But she, I say to her, do we need to dispose of that body? And she said, no, he's not dead yet. But what had apparently happened was that the night before, remember, George is there by himself at night. He had wanted to do something other than sit on his chair. And in order to do that, he would need to get from the Lazy Boy to the office maneuvering vehicle, which is just one of those regular office chairs with wheels. And because that's what we pushed him around on. We weren't equipped to deal with a dying man on a daily basis. And so he, during that transition, he fell onto the floor. And sometimes you see that on those home video shows, and it's kind of funny, but this was not funny. It took him 2 hours to crawl from where he had landed to the desk where he could pull down the phone, and at this point he was lying in a puddle of his own urine, and he gets the phone down, and you would think he would call 911. It's only three buttons, right? But no, he tries to call Mark, who is before there was a lot of available cable internet, and Mark was apparently using his dial-up to look at some internet pornography, and so he could not get through. And so he called Pam and says, Pam, I'm on the floor, get Mark and help. And she says, okay, George, we'll get help. Hung up the phone and dialed 911, then went over to Mark's house, had him put on some pants, and then they went to the facility where the paramedics had been there. They'd broken into the front door, and they run back to the office, and there's George on his chair. I guess the paramedic got there and found George on the floor and said, Jesus, we better get you to the hospital. And George said, just put me back on the chair. It's where I want to die, or something like that. And so the paramedics had come, but still George was there. But the fall hurt him badly, and he realized that he needed to go to the hospital for the drugs. And so he finally agreed to be shipped back off to Massachusetts, where his wife would take over, admit him to the hospital. He gets into the hospital. He did not have spinal cancer. He had a staph infection that, had he gone to the hospital 2 months ago, could have probably been easily treated. But instead, he needed bone grafts from his hips to his vertebrae, and he needed to wear a halo where they screw that stuff right into your skull, and then you can't move your head. For 3 months, he had to wear this. And He did recover entirely. He was fine. But we were held captive by this man's insanity and stubbornness. There is a little bit of an epilogue to this story, but I'm getting long here. So if you see me walking around somewhere and you want to know, ask me, I'll tell you. But let me leave you with two pieces of advice. If ever you get to the point where moving from one chair to another becomes a matter of life or death, and that is a new situation for you, go to the hospital. And try not to put your subordinates in that kind of predicament, because they might end up telling everybody right here. It's good storytelling. Thank you.
Okay, so before we get into it with Kevin, we want to thank Golden West, which is a Southwestern vegan forward restaurant on the avenue that has been doing a great job during COVID feeding people and keeping their employees and customers safe. And we want to thank Baltimore Magazine, which has been a great sponsor of the podcast. You can find them on the newsstand, online, and check out all their latest reporting on everything in Baltimore. Okay, so Kevin.
Yes, hello.
Okay, well, the first thing I want to ask has to do with the last part of the story where you say, I don't have enough time
to tell you the
residents, but there's a little epilogue. If you see me in the lobby, you know, I'll tell you. So what was it? How many people saw you in the lobby and came up and asked you, like, just dish on that, would you?
Well, I think that I actually said that if you see me walking around somewhere, it wasn't just the lobby.
Oh, okay.
But the statute of limitations has long expired on that offer. So I'm
okay.
But honestly, I have chosen not to publicly discuss that portion of the story, just because it's a little too personal. It answered some questions as to why everything happened. And I mean, I had up until the moment I went on to tell that story, I had some serious internal deliberation about whether it was ethical at all for me to be telling this story. This was about a person that was still alive, someone that I hadn't talked to. He didn't know that I was going to be telling this story. It seemed like somewhat of a shaming situation in some regards. And I didn't change his name. George is his real name. So, it was such an abusive situation. I ended up feeling at least that it's justified.
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, when you were, on roles and responsibilities does not include, I would assume, cleaning testicles in the employee shower.
Absolutely was not part of my job description.
You know, it's interesting because the story is funny, but I guess it in a way belies the question, like, could you have said no? Like, or did you feel like the power dynamics of the office, the hierarchy, your desire to keep your job were all on the line?
All of that. And at the same time, you don't want someone in that position, even though that power dynamic was off. You can't, it's very difficult to see someone suffering in such a way. And so the story, I told the story and it's a humorous story to hear it. And but living that, it was not quite as funny. After I told that story and sort of made its rounds a bit, and some of my colleagues at the time would call me up and say, Kevin, I just heard that's your story. And oh my God, why are you traumatizing us like this? The funniest part is the most terrifying part, that every single piece of that was absolutely true. A lot of people have said to me, that can't be that must be made up. This can't be an actual story. This can't have actually happened. And every single part of it was 100% true.
And how old were you at the time? You were in your 20s, right? When you were working there?
Oh, Jessica. late 20s, early 30s.
And everyone that was, and he was older. So everyone that was supporting him was definitely a subordinate and younger.
Yes, right? he was the person. He was everyone's boss. He was the person that, because we had been that company had been sold to another company, and he was the person that was there to lead the operation.
Yeah.
And this was a remote situation. So the people that he worked for from this parent company, they were far away.
So did everybody that you knew at the office felt the same, like this was abusive, but also he was suffering? So it's like you're really, really torn on how to behave in this situation.
Absolutely. That's and again, the choice is either leave him there to suffer or assist. And there's no way to not help someone that's in such a predicament.
Yeah.
God, and you had worked there for a while, right?
Yes. This is, I guess I had worked there for a couple, three years at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were invested, and it would have been like hard to just walk away from the job altogether. And that's just not in your, like, that's just not how you operate anyway.
It's true. That's true. I'm dedicated, Jessica.
Except you did walk away from Jessica, or one of you guys walked away from each other. But anyway,
that's true. We can mine that vein a little later.
You know what's really weirding me out, though? Your voice sounds really similar to Jessica's current husband, Aaron Henkin's voice. So I'm just going to put that out there. But anyway, you know, it's weird because in a way, he doesn't sound like the typical tyrant, like powerful boss, like, because you described him as kind of boisterous and like loud, but more like a, you know, like a puppy loud than like a, you know, than shouting people down. And yet it's like he had the power and privilege of being completely unaware or uninterested in what the effect of his decision making was on all y'all, you know?
Yes, that is true.
I mean, that's power and privilege, is to be like, I'm going to go ahead and do what I don't even have to think about how this affects you.
Correct. That is exactly what was happening.
And so now you're CFO of a company that has employees that are roughly the same age as you were around the time that you were this story was taking place in your life. Do you ever think about, like, how does that inform your leadership?
let's just first confirm you're not living at the store or the office right now, are you?
I am not living there. I've only spent one night there in my entire life, and that was during a hurricane.
Okay. So
that is correct. I do not live there. No one is caring for me, and it definitely has instilled I'd like to exhibit servant leadership because of George in a lot of ways. Absolutely. I like to get into the trenches with everyone.
Okay.
I mean, I like to be working with everyone. I'm the CFO, but I do so many other things. Every day of the week, I am pushing a cart of product up the hill from our storage area in our headquarters up to the restaurant, for example. I'm in there working with everybody hands-on every day in some regard. And that I think that's very important.
And how you've been there for a long time now, right?
I have been at the Conscious Corner for 16 years now.
Wow. Yeah. Yes.
Well, tell people who don't know what it is.
Okay. So we are located in Clarksville and Olney, Maryland. We have Roots Market, which is the best and most vegan-centric full-service grocery store anywhere around. We have Great Sage, our award-winning restaurant. Nest is our gift and apparel shop. And we have a partner store called Red, which provides beer and wine during these troubling times.
Interesting.
That's what we do. It's an amazing place to work. I'm so fortunate to have found those folks all those years. I'm the CFO, but I've never even one time taken an accounting class in my life.
So how do you know how to do your figuring?
I learned on the job mostly. I mean, the figuring in general, general counting and such, I learned back when Jessica and I used to work at Mike's Wholesale Bait Service because we used to count worms together.
God,
That's where I got my start.
We need that story.
But when I applied for the job all those years ago, I was on severance from another company had purchased the company that George had worked for, and I was on this long severance period, which was the most amazing period of my life.
Well, can I say how you were making your money during this time?
Jessica, you can say anything that you would like.
So the way, while you were on severance and you were on unemployment, first time you were ever like unemployed since high school, because you worked at APET throughout high school.
That is true.
You?
I just started talking to some folks from APET just a few weeks ago. FYI.
So you took for whatever reason, you decided that the way that you were going to make money was by collecting and selling Magic the Gathering cards, which is precursor.
Yes, I know what it is.
Well, those who don't, it's like a precursor to Pokemon. Like, you know, there were these rare. It was a game that you played with cards. Very fantasy oriented, kind of like adjacent Dungeons and Dragons adjacent, I guess. And you would go to like 11-year-old boys' house with their mom's present and like do a deal. I remember you had binders full of these cards, and anyway, and you made like thousands of dollars. You made a lot of money.
You said it played in the past tense. It's a wildly popular game still today.
Right.
And as I am speaking to you, I am currently right now, if I look around, I am surrounded by probably 50,000 Magic cards at this very moment.
Oh my god.
No joke.
Are you still trading them?
Yes, absolutely. Jessica, you are we were living together when that first happened, when that first came into my life, the Magic the Gathering.
Because you would go down, anyway, sorry, we could go down this memory lane, but I remember that, in like Ellicott City, right? Is that where the...
You worked in Ellicott City, and I would go and visit you and then walk up the street to that little store, I don't know what it's become now, it was a theater as well, and on the corner there in Ellicott City.
This is all just too cute and weird. Oh my God. Let me ask you this, and maybe this will be part of what you don't want to talk about with regard to the George situation, but did he ever come back? Like, once he recovered and returned to the office, how was he different? How were you all different?
He never came back to the office. That portion of the epilogue started with him calling. Once he was fully recovered, he called one day while I was working and said, "Kevin, I need you. You know, again, we're at work. We're trying to run this business we don't have that many employees. It was a small business, and there was a lot of work to be done." He said, "I need you to gather a group of people, a group of employees, and go to my apartment. And I'm giving up that lease, so I need you to take all of my things back from the apartment and put it in your warehouse and clean out my apartment."
Oh my God! Again,
just a continuation of that inappropriate request that he would constantly make, and the details of that's the epilogue, and again, we're not going to get into that publicly.
But you did do that, or you guys didn't?
Yes,
do that?
Yes, we did. Of course, we did that.
Oh my God!
All his personal belongings, and that's crazy. That's crazy.
We discovered some answers.
Oh God damn! Can't you tell us?
Again, if you see me walking around on the streets somewhere. Maybe.
Oh man. Yeah, I understand. I understand. And I do understand. I do understand how you would be having those conflicting feelings right before sharing this story, because you know, you don't want to be a bully. You don't want to be someone who just talks about someone who can't defend themselves, you know, but I think the abuse of the situation and the absurdity of it and it's halfway possible that if he heard the story, he wouldn't be offended.
You are, that is possible, certainly. But I don't know. But really, right up until the moment I walked on stage, I was not entirely sure I was doing the right thing. Speaking of that, going on stage, can I talk a bit about the experience itself?
Go for it.
So it was a terrifying and exhilarating experience for me. It was so far out of my comfort zone. It's not something that I'd ever really done. I'd never done anything quite like it. I haven't really since. And typically, when someone tells a stupid story, they said they have an idea and they send you to a synopsis, and you look it over and you talk to them about it and you say, that sounds good. We'll put you in, maybe we'll pencil you into this show or whatnot. Is that how it happens? That's how I remember it happening.
We have one coaching session. Did you come to a workshop?
Well, okay. I did, but my situation was slightly different because about 3 weeks before the actual event, just 3 weeks before this event was happening, I got a phone call from my friend Jessica. And yes. Jessica says, Kevin, hi, it's Jessica. We have a Stoop event happening in 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks. We need another storyteller, and it's going to be you.
And I believe it.
I said, what is it even about? And you said, well, it's about work. And so Jessica and I had worked together in a number of interesting scenarios. So I imagine you figured I had something to say on the topic. But yes. But my whole life, I've never been able to say no to Jessica. So this is like the whole reason that I told this story was because Jessica is a bully. But the
So basically, she just replicated the trauma of that George did for you.
Yes, I mean,
you
know, she was absolutely.
You again. She made you watch Jessica. Her testicles, didn't she?
Well, again, we'll talk about that a little later. But the
only right after I get them waxed, because they're very tender.
Anyway.
So if I recall correctly, I think I remembered talking with her and hearing a little bit about this bait farm that you worked at and thinking that you would,
yes.
I assumed that's what you were going to talk about.
Yeah. And that's what I imagined she thought that I would talk about as well.
Yeah. Yep. That's what I thought.
And there are plenty of stories about the bait farm, maybe that's another Stoop story down the road. I'll tell you something else I remember very distinctly about telling the story, or about the event in itself. My parents were my sister, they were all in the audience, and my parents had purchased these tickets long before. I wasn't even going to tell them that I was going to be there. But a few days before, Jesse, you told them.
Yeah.
I think that maybe my father was your kid's pediatrician.
Yes,
pediatrician.
Yes. Yeah.
He said, we're going to see you at the Stoop. And you said, oh, you'll see Kevin telling his story. And they said, what?
So, oh my God.
But then my father called me that night and said, you're telling a story there. And so he was excited about that. But so the night of the event, you had me going on right before intermission. Immediately after some of the strongest performers that you had, Megan Schutt and Jim Meyer, who's a professional comedian, you had me going on right after him. And I didn't tell my parents what it was that I was going to talk. They didn't tell them anything about it. And so after, so I told the story and went back into the lobby during intermission. And I saw my father there, and he walked up to me, and I will never forget the look in his eyes. He was just sort of staring at me in awe, because I had not somehow not blown it. And it was the first time in my entire life that my father was proud or impressed by something that I had done. So
Really?
Both for giving me the experience of parental recognition once in my life.
That is not true. Your father adores you. Oh my God. That is so
nice. It is 100% true. Guy thinks I'm a loser. But
Well, then he went on to share a Stoop story. I remember
he did. He did. Everyone should listen to that. Ken Hoffman's story is also quite good. Not as funny, but
yes. No, you were, I mean, it's so interesting to hear how nervous you were, or how whatever the word is, unsure, because it's so funny and it's so well told, and it's the best kind of funny, because it's these details that are true, and they're just so strange they could only be true. So it was the pleasure of how surreal this thing was, but never once did I, and I don't think anyone in the audience, think you're making this up, because it's just too weird to make up, you know?
I do. It's too absurd to have made something like that up. But yes, I was clearly very, again, it was out of my realms entirely. I was there against my will, Jessica.
And yes, but you know what? That is how we got a lot of our storytellers early on. Jessica's ex-boyfriends were recruited.
But I could not be. I'm so grateful that you had me on to do that. It was a defining moment in my life, thank you very much. Seriously.
I was so proud of you. And it was, we were laughing so hard. You knocked it out of the park. It was great. And I knew you would, though. So that's the thing. I knew you would.
Well, and just the weirdness of offices, how office people can be like families and in all the dysfunctional ways. And, you know, it has flavors of The Office, you know, anyway, do you like being a boss?
I don't even really think of myself as a boss, honestly. I think of myself as just one amongst many colleagues.
Yeah.
Doing important work the important work that we do for the community.
Yeah.
Well, and the work that you do now is very much in line with your ethos around, you know, animal advocacy and being vegan and all of that. So it's nice to see that you found that, as opposed to
the bait farm, but the
researching for infectious diseases, which I would imagine would have some amount of animal research in it. Potentially,
it is true. That's one of the things that we did at that facility was we manufactured mouse serum, which is we had a colony of poor mice there, and they would be injected with a sarcoma virus or something into their abdominal cavity, and they would produce ascites, and then that would be removed. The giant needle, and I never dealt with the mice themselves, but I would deal with the finished product, where we'd have hundreds of liters of this stuff, and I would have to purify it, and so that's always weighed on me that I was participating in that.
Wow.
Well, now can we talk about So Kevin, can you talk about your pet situation at home? Who do you have at home? Well, first, let's talk about your dog.
My dog, we have a dog named Annie, and she is a monster.
Yes.
She's a rescue, terrible creature. We love her. She's a rescued miniature pincher.
Yep.
And we knew nothing about that breed of dog when we just saw this cute dog on the internet, and Amy and I said, we should get that dog, and went and picked, we took her after meeting her one time, and the first thing that happened when we met her, we sat on a sofa, Annie jumped up into Amy's lap, then I sat down next to her, and Annie spent the next 5 minutes growling at me.
And then who else do you have in your house?
So, and then in addition to Annie, we have currently 19 rescued wild mice that I care for.
Oh my God. So you're doing penance.
But when you say wild mice, there's just some mice that, like the mice that like women back in the 50s would like hit with a broom. You have created a Shangri-La.
A sanctuary. Yeah, it's a sanctuary for wild mice in our laundry room.
They have an Instagram account, right?
Well, no, you can come see them on my Instagram account. Go vegan, please.
Okay.
You can see all of the mice there.
You've created various like mansions and things like that for them, right?
Yes, I like to make sure they are having a fantastic life. These creatures. I've spent the last 7 years doing this. I think I've had in my care 50 mice. People know that I take care of mice, and they'll find mice and they'll raise these mice from tiny babies and bring them to me, and then I care for them for the rest of their lives.
Struck by how this time in this particular office, doing the work you did with the people you did, really shaped, like, it pointed you in the opposite direction. I mean, it really shaped your life.
It certainly did. I remember being in, we would have strategic planning meetings and such, and I would always be voicing my opposition to the mouse program in general, and eventually it went away. But yes, this had all of these things have had quite an effect on my life in general.
Wow, God. And it's all because of Jessica.
It is. Everything goes back to Jessica.
It really does.
For a while.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, you can share your story. I was going to say every subsequent girlfriend after me, I introduced you to for a while. Do you remember that?
That is true. Yes. And we even lived together. You and I would live together I had a new girlfriend. You had a new boyfriend. We still all live together. I will tell a story about the very beginning and the very end of our romantic entanglement.
Yes. Yes, please. Yes.
I knew Jessica in high school, but only peripherally. We had some friends in common, and we went to different schools. But Jessica worked at Tower Records, and I was there most every weekend. And I knew that she was this person that was someone I wanted to know better, but never did in high school. And then I went to Goucher College for a year, and then transferred to UMBC. And I think it was the end of my sophomore year or the beginning of the junior year. One day I was rushing to class, and I saw this person who on an exterior payphone, which you don't see those very much anymore, long reddish hair, and I swear that's Jessica Miles. That's your maiden name.
Yes.
I was late, and she was on the phone, so I couldn't stop and talk. But I couldn't. Then I went home for that weekend to my parents' house, and I remember just thinking about that moment, and thinking that I need to talk to this person. So I recruited my sister Lara. This is before there was any internet at all. We got the Annapolis phone book out, and I made her help me go through and call every person named Miles in the phone book, asking for Jessica. But it was a fruitless endeavor, because I was too stupid to realize that Miles might be spelled differently than M-I-L-E-S.
So many fewer M-Y-L-E-S.
Yes, that is the truth. It was a whole Friday night, I remember.
Oh my God.
But I don't know how we actually met up. That was not how, but I clearly remember that doing that. And then let's skip forward a few years.
Yeah.
You and I were living together with with a roommate in Catonsville.
Who was the future mayor of Annapolis?
Yes, exactly. Is there Josh Cohen? We were living together with Josh, and I remember one evening, Josh and I were sitting on the sofa playing Tony La Russa baseball on our Sega Genesis, and Jessica walks into the department and says, "Kevin, we need to talk." And I said, "Ah, fuck, right now?" And Josh paused the game. And so Jessica and I went into the bedroom, and I remember sitting on the bed, and you said, "This clearly isn't working. We need to end this relationship as it is." And I said, "I agree." And I remember you were crying, and I would never cry. But but we were sitting, and I remember sitting there for probably 5 minutes, just sort of looking at each other. And then I said, "Okay, can I please go finish my baseball game now?"
Oh, and my God.
But soon, not that long after that, Jessica's new boyfriend moved into this. This is my apartment. My name was on the lease. This was Jessica's new boyfriend moved into our bedroom, and they kicked me out into the living room onto this sort of foam fold out sofa thing.
Oh my Lord!
When I went off to college at first.
No, it wasn't the foam. No, it wasn't the foam.
Yes, it was.
No, it was the black couch that we got from your grandma's house that had a pull-out.
Those were both in that room. But my grandma's house, that's true. And then, but I would get calls when I was working at Mike's bait service at that moment. I would get calls in the middle of the day from Jessica saying, "Kevin, you need to come back to the apartment after work. My boyfriend freaked out and he broke all your stuff. You need to help me trash the apartment." And so I would come.
Wait, what?
And of course, I can't say no to Jessica, so I would come help her fix all the damage that was caused in my apartment by her new boyfriend.
By my terrible new boyfriend. Anyway, it was a bad decision. And that is the truth. That is the beginning. That was the beginning and end of our relationship.
Wow.
Not our friendship.
No,
we have stayed friends all these years.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Miraculous, yeah.
Oh my God. Very interesting. So, you know, Jessica asking you to come back to your apartment where you've been evicted from your room to help clean up the mess from her new boyfriend. I'm just, you know what? It's George. Yeah. He's George.
He is George.
I've solved this for you, Kevin. I've connected all these dots. Yeah.
Jessica, I think maybe we can't be friends anymore.
Oh, changed so much though. That was me before SSRIs. I think that's a significant thing to point out. I've never comported myself in such a way since being on SSRIs.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. Well, this has been so fun. This is really everything about it. Listening to your story, hearing you talk about what it was like to share the story, hearing you walk down memory lane with George / Jessica, all of it has really been great. And I really hope I do bump into you on the street and you can whisper the epilogue to me, because I can't even imagine.
Yeah, let's make that happen.
All right,
we'll do it. Thank you both for allowing me to have contributed to the arc of the Stoop storytelling story itself.
Oh man, I think we need to have you back though. We need a bait farm story.
Oh yeah,
and it would. Yes, I want to hear that story. That sounds like all kinds of crazy to me.
Okay, I'll start working on that for you right now.
Yeah, maybe we could. Yeah, we have to think of a theme for that. Maybe like dirty jobs or some version of that. But oh, good Lord.
Sitting in my corner, don't know what to think.
I can't speak. Okay. Yeah. Well, before we get out of here, we want to thank The Wine Source, which is on Elm Avenue in Hamden. They're a great sponsor of the podcast, and they have all kinds of good drinks and food to get you through this difficult time. We want to thank Maureen Harvey, who produces the Stoop podcast, and we want to let you know that you can visit stoopstorytelling.com to check out our upcoming fall shows. We have a show coming up in just a few weeks, September 22nd. It's a virtual show, so you can watch it from anywhere. And the theme is Of Substance, stories about our complicated relationships with alcohol and drugs. So it's stories about using alcohol and drugs and abusing them. And the stories range from the really funny to the really, really difficult. And then we have shows in October and November as well. So check us out at stoopstorytelling.com. And thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next time.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Take you both.